icily furious as Cast and Vetus left, fists clenching and reclenching. "Pair of self-deluding fuckwits," she spat. "They know I'm right, but it's Guyan. They're so used to doing what that mad son of a bitch says." She glared at Holston, as if daring him to gainsay her. In fact, the historian had felt a certain sympathy with Cast's position, but plainly that was not what Lane wanted to hear. "So what will you do?" he asked. "Oh, we'll act," Lane swore. "Let Cast keep his precious guns locked up. We've got one workshop up and running, and I've already started weapons production. They won't be pretty, but they'll be better than knives and clubs." "And Guyan?" "If he's got any sense, he's doing the same. But I'm better at it. I'm engineering, after all." "Lane, are you sure you want a war?" She stopped. The regard she turned on Holston was a look from another time. That of a martyr. A warrior queen of legend. "Holston, this isn't just about me not liking Guyan. It isn't because I want his job or I think he's a bad person. I've taken my own best professional judgment, and I believe that if he goes ahead with uploading his mind, then he will overload the Gilgamesh's system, causing a fatal clash of both our tech and the Empire stuff we've salvaged. And when that happens, everyone dies. And I mean everyone. I don't care if Vetus wants to make notes for some non-existent posterity, or if Cast won't get off the fucking fence. It's up to me. It's up to me and my crew. You're lucky. You woke late, and then you got to sit in a box for a bit. Some of us have been pushing every which way for a long time trying to turn this around. And now, I'm basically an outlaw on my own ship. At open war with my commander, whose crazy fanatic followers will kill me on sight. And I am going to lead my engineers into fucking battle and actually kill people. Because if someone doesn't, then Guyan kills everyone. Now are you with me?" "You know I am." The words sounded tremulous and hollow to Holston himself, but Lane seemed to accept them. They were attacked as they were crossing into what Lane seemed to consider her territory. The interior of the Gilgamesh made for odd tactics, a network of small chambers and passages fitted into the torus of the crew area, bent and twisted like an afterthought around the essential machinery that had been put in first. They had just reached a heavy safety door that Lane, in the lead, obviously expected to open automatically. When it slid a shuddering inch, then stopped, there was no obvious suspicion amongst the engineers. It seemed to Holston that under the present regime, little things must be going wrong all the time. With a toolcase already in hand, one of them pried off a service plate, and Holston heard the words, "Chief, this has been tampered with," before a hatch above them was kicked open, and three ragged figures dropped upon them with ear-splitting howls. They had long knives, surely nothing from the armory, so Guyan's people had been improvising, and they were absolutely berserk. Holston saw one of Lane's people reel back, blood spitting from a broad wound across her body, and the rest were down to grappling hand to hand almost immediately. Lane had her gun out but was denied a target, a lack that was rectified when another half dozen appeared, running full tilt from the direction they had come. The weapon barked three times, colossally loud in the confined space. One of the robed figures spun away, his battle cry abruptly turning into a scream. Holston just ducked, hands over his head, his view of the fight reduced to a chaos of knees and feet. Historian to the last, his thought was, this is what it must have been like on Earth at the very end, when all else was lost. This is what we left Earth to avoid. It's been following after us all this time. Then someone kicked him in the chin, probably entirely without malice, and he was sent sprawling, trampled and stamped on, under the thrashing feet of the Malay. He saw Lane's gun smashed from her hand. Someone fell across his legs heavily, and he felt one knee being wrenched as far as it would go. A shockingly distinct and insistent pain amidst all the confusion. He struggled to get free, and found himself furiously kicking at the expiring weight of one of Guyan's mad monks. His mind, which had temporarily given up any illusion of control, was wondering whether the commander had promised some sort of posthumous reward for his minions, and whether that promise was any consolation with a torn-open stomach. Suddenly he was clear, and scrabbling at the wall to regain his feet. His twisted knee savagely resisted bearing any of his weight, but he was adrenaline to the eyeballs right then, and overrode it. That got him all of 2 steps away from the skirmish, whereupon he was grabbed. Without warning, 2 of Guyon's bigger goons were on him, and he saw a knife glinting in one hand. He screamed, something to the tune of begging for his life, and then they bounced him off the wall for good measure. He was convinced he was about to die, his imagination leaping ahead, trying to brace him against the coming thrust by picturing the blade already in him in agonizing detail. He lived through the sickening lurch of impact, the cold keening of the knife, the warm upsurge of blood as those parts of him that his skin had kept imprisoned for so very, very long finally took their chance at freedom. He was living it in his head. Only belatedly did he realize that they had not stabbed him at all. Instead, the 2 of them were hurrying him away from the fight, heedless of his staggering, limping gait. With a start of horror, as though this was worse than a stabbing, he realized that this was not just random gang warfare, Guyon versus Lane. This was the High Priest of the Gilgamesh recovering his property. Chapter 5.4 The Right to Life. Fabian is brought into Portia's presence after his escorts return him to the pier house. Her reaction on seeing him is a mixture of relief and frustration. He has been missing for most of the day. Now he is brought into a room of angled sides deep within the pier group's domain, where Portia hangs from the ceiling and frets. This is not the first time that he has evaded his custodians and gone walkabout, but today he was retrieved from the lower reaches of the Great Nest, closest to the ground, a haunt of hungry females who either lack or have left their peer groups. The habitat of the busy multitudes of maintenance colonies, whose insect bodies keep the city free from refuse. An abode of the numberless, hopeless, unwanted males. For someone like Fabian, it is a good place to go to die. Portia is furious. There is a genuine streak of fear for his well-being that he can read in her jittery body language. You could have been killed. Fabian himself is very calm. Yes, I could. Why would you do such a thing? She demands. Have you ever been there? He is crouching by the room's entrance, his round eyes staring up at her, still as stones when he is not actually speaking. With her elevated stance that would let her leap on him and pin him in an instant, there is a curious tension between them, hunter and prey, female and male. The ground down there is a tattered mess of broken silk, he tells her, of hastily built shacks where dozens of males sleep each night. They live like animals, day to day. They prey on the ants and are preyed on in turn. The ground is littered with the drained husks where the females have made meals of them. Portia's words thrum towards him through the boundaries of the room. All the more reason to be grateful for what you have and not risk yourself. Her palps flash white anger. I could have been killed, he echoes, matching her stance and therefore her intonation perfectly. I could have lived my entire life there. And died without memory or achievement. What separates me from them? You are of value, Portia insists. You are a male of exceptional ability, one to be celebrated, to be protected and encouraged to prosper. What have you ever been denied that you have asked for? Only one thing. He walks forwards a few careful steps, as though he is feeling out the strands of a web that only he can see. His palps move lazily. His progress is almost a dance, something of the courtship, but laced with bitterness. Theirs is a voiceless language of many subtle shades. They are like us, and you know it. You cannot know what they might have achieved if they had been allowed to live and to prosper. For a moment she does not even know what he means. But she sees his mind is still focused on that detritus of doomed males, whose lives will take them no further than the foot of the trees. They are of no value or worth. But you cannot know that. There could be a dozen geniuses dying every day. who have never had an opportunity to demonstrate their aptitude. They think, as we do. They plan and hope and fear. Merely see them, and that connection would strum between you. They are my brothers. No less so. They are yours. Portia disagrees vehemently. If they were of any quality or caliber, then they would ascend by their own virtues. Not if there was no structure that they could possibly climb. Not if all the structure that exists was designed to disenfranchise them. Portia, I could have been killed. You yourself said it. I could have been taken by some starving female, and nothing in that would be seen as wrong, save that it might anger you. He has stepped closer, and she feels the predator in her twitch, as if he were some blind insect blundering too close, inviting the strike. Portia's rear legs close up, building muscle tension for the spring that she is fighting against. And still you are not grateful that I think enough of you that your life is preserved. His palps twitch with frustration. You know how many males busy themselves around Great Nest. You know that we fulfill thousands of small roles and even some few great ones. If we were to leave the city all at once, or if some plague were to rid you of all your males, the nest would collapse. And yet every one of us has nothing more than we are given, and that can be taken away from us just as swiftly. Each one of us lives in constant fear that our usefulness will come to an end, and that we will be replaced by some more elegant dancer, some new favourite, or that we will please too much, and mate, and then be too slow to escape the throes of your passion. That is the way things are. Following her argument with Bianca, Portia is finding this polemic too much to deal with. She feels as though her beloved Great Nest is under assault from all sides, and most from those who ought to be her allies. Things are the way we make them. Abruptly, his pose changes, and he is stepping sideways, away from her, loosening that taut bond of predation that was building between them. You asked about my discovery before. My grand project. Playing his game, Portia comes down from her roost, one leg at a time, while still keeping that careful distance. Yes? She signals with her palps. I've devised a new form of chemical architecture. His manner has changed completely from the intensity of a moment before. Now he seems disinterested, cerebral. To what end? She creeps closer and he steps away again. Not fleeing her, but following that unseen web of his own invention. To any end? To no end. In and of itself, my new architecture carries no instructions, no commands. It sets the ants no tasks or behaviours. Then what good is it? He stops, looking up at her again, having lured her this close. It can do anything. A secondary architecture can be distributed to the colony, to work within the primary. And another, and another. A colony could be given a new task instantly, and its members would change with the speed of the scent as it passes from ant to ant. Different castes could be made receptive to different instructions, allowing the colony to pursue multiple tasks all at once. A single colony could follow sequences of separate tasks without the need for lengthy reconditioning. Once my base architecture is in place, every colony can be reconfigured for every new task, as often as needed. The efficiency of mechanical tasks would increase tenfold. Our ability to undertake calculations would increase at least 100-fold, perhaps 1,000-fold, depending on the economy of the secondary architecture. Portia has stopped still, stunned. She understands enough of how her kind's organic technology works to grasp the magnitude of what he is proposing. If it can be done, then Fabian will have surpassed the chief limiting factor that is frustrating the temple even now, and that is preventing them from giving true reality to the messenger's plan. The break will come off the advancement of their species. You have this understanding now?
I do. The primary architecture is actually surprisingly simple. Building complex things out of simple things is the basis of the idea. It's like building a web. I also have a system for constructing any secondary architecture fit for any task required. It is like a language, a concise, mathematical language. He stalks forwards a few steps, as if teasing her. You will appreciate it. It is as beautiful as the first message. You must pass this understanding to me immediately. For a moment, Portia feels the strong desire to mate with him, to take his genetic material into herself, with its newfound understanding, to set down immediately the first of the next generation who will rule the world. Perhaps she should instead have him distill his new knowledge so that she can drink it and understand it herself, rather than leave it to her offspring. But the thought seems intimidating. How will the world look when he gives her the secret of unlocking the future? He does not speak. His shuffling feet and trembling palps suggest an odd coyness. "Fabian, you must pass on this understanding," she repeats. "I cannot imagine how you thought risking yourself could be acceptable, if you hold this knowledge." He has ventured quite close, almost within the span of her forelegs. He is a little more than half her size, weaker, slower, more fragile, and yet so valuable.
"So unlike the rest of my kind?"
It is as if he has read her mind. "But I am not, or you cannot know if I am or am not. How many understandings are extinguished every day?"
"None like yours," she tells him promptly.
"You can never know. That is the problem with ignorance. You can never truly know the extent of what you are ignorant about. I will not do it." She physically recoils.
"Explain yourself."
"It dies with me. I will not distill this understanding. I will take steps to prevent it being taken by force." For, of course, there were chemical countermeasures for that now, as well.
"Why would you do such a thing?"
Fabian looks direct into her eyes.
"Unless."
"Unless?" she prompts.
"You are the preeminent priestess of Great Nest. I think there is no female more influential than you," Fabian observes, still watching her intently.
"You wish to mate?" she begins tentatively, because Portia is finding some difficulty in knowing what he, a pampered male, can really want that he does not already have for the asking.
"No, I wish you to go to your peer group, and to Temple, and to the other great matriarchs of Great Nest, and tell them that there will be a new law. Tell them that to kill a male shall be as abhorrent to them as to kill another female. Tell them that my brothers deserve to live."
She freezes because, yes, there have been deranged philosophers in the past who might put up such an idea as an intellectual exercise, and there are those other cities where the males assumed more of the work after the ravages of the plague and have never quite let go. But that is not Great Nest, and Great Nest's way is the true way, the preferred path of the messenger. Within her, biology and custom are at war. There is a place in her mind where the nanovirus lurks, and it tells her that all her species are kin, are like her, in a way that other creatures are not. And yet the weight of society crushes its voice. Males have their place. She knows this.
"Don't be foolish. You cannot equate every ignorant, crawling male with one such as yourself. Of course you are protected and valued for your accomplishments. That is only natural, that merit be rewarded. The great host of males beneath us, though, the surplus, what use are they? What good are they? You are an exceptional male, something female got into you in the egg to make you thus. But you cannot expect my sisters to blindly extend such consideration to every male in the city just because of you. What would we do with them? Put them to work. Find their strengths. Train them. Use them."
Apparently, Fabian has given this matter some thought.
"Use them as what? What use can they be?"
"You can never know, because you do not try." She rears up in frustration, sending him scuttling back,
momentarily terrified. She would not have struck, but for a moment she wonders if that sudden injection of fear might assist her argument. When he settles himself across the chamber from her, though, he seems even more resolved.
"What you ask is unnatural," she tells him sternly, controlling herself. "There is nothing about what we do that is natural. If we prized the natural, we would still be hunting spitters in the wilderness, or falling prey to the jaws of ants, instead of mastering our world. We have made a virtue of the unnatural."
She does not trust herself to answer, so she scurries past him, almost knocking him aside.
"You will reconsider,"
she tells him, pausing in the doorway to beat out the rhythms of her anger.
"You will give up this foolish dream."
Fabian watches her go, eyes glinting with rebellion. He cannot simply walk out of the pier house. From a genuine concern for his safety, Portia has given instructions that Fabian is not to leave. She does not see it as imprisonment. It is simply not fitting for any male to wander freely. Valued males who have secured the patronage of powerful females are expected to be at their beck and call, or to labour out of sight for their betters. Other males are preferably out of sight as well as out of mind. Fabian paces the boundaries of his laboratory chamber, knowing that he must manufacture an exit, but fearful of taking that irreversible step. If he leaves now, after that confrontation with Portia, he will be leaving behind everything he has known. Curiosity is built into the spider genome, but in males it is not encouraged. Fabian is fighting centuries of conditioning. Finally, he conquers his timidity and sends out a chemical signal. Shortly afterwards, the scent is picked up by a handful of ants from the city maintenance colonies, passing nearby on their endless round of duties. Their entire colony has been reprogrammed by Fabian, his master architecture already set in place. Nobody has noticed, because the secondary structures that guide the colony about its task are functionally identical to those that were originally bred into the ants generations before, if a little more elegantly designed. Now, though, the pheromones that Fabian has released instill new behaviours in these individuals, bringing them to the silk side of his chamber, where they cut a neat exit wound for him to depart through. After they are done, he resets them, and they go about their duties with no sign that they were ever subverted. Fabian has been busy these last months in testing his discovery, with the whole of Great Nest as his experimental subject. He has listened to the news constantly recycled by the peer group. He knows who is causing Portia distress, who has tried to challenge the order of the world, other than himself. He is a male, vulnerable from the moment he slips from the pier house. He knows where he needs to go, but he fears journeying alone. He needs a guardian. He needs a female, in fact, however much he might regret that. Fabian's ideal female has three characteristics. She must be intellectually useful, so a commodity in her own right. She must be in a position of weakness that will allow even a male to bargain with her. She must have no interest in mating with him or otherwise harming him. Regarding the last, he knows he must trust to chance. The first two criteria have already suggested a travelling companion. He knows who has caused Portia to fret most. Fabian is going to see Bianca. He pauses halfway down the tree trunk from the pier house, gazing back up at its complex collection of suspended chambers and tents. For a moment he is uncertain. Should he not trust the safety of its walls and give up his ambitions? And what will Portia think once she finds him gone? She represents all that he intends to overthrow, and yet he likes and respects her, and she has always done her best for him. Everything he has accomplished has been made possible only by what Portia has given him. But no, it is that kind of gifting that he must break away from. A life lived entirely at the whim of another is no life at all. He has always been surprised at the large number of other males who see matters differently, revelling in their own cosseted captivity. Previous excursions outside have given him the opportunity to lay groundwork, and where he has not travelled himself, he has sent his proxies instead. His new chemical architecture allows him to use ants as the delivery agent of his instructions, with colonies programming other colonies. Nobody suspects just how far this has all gone. He suborned the prison colony relatively recently, paving the way for his insurrection. When he arrives, the ants at the tunnel mouth start forwards, antennae waving, mandibles wide in challenge. He releases a distinct, simple scent, a back door into their societal structures, and they are instantly his. With a rapid cycling of olfactory clues, he alters their behaviour in specific, precise ways. The tunnel guards turn and enter their colony, unleashing a cascade of his amended architecture throughout their fellows. Fabian follows them in, as though they are his honour guard. It takes him time to find Bianca's chamber amongst all the others held in custody. Great Nest holds no prisoners for long, executing the males and exiling females. But as the temple tightens its dogmatic grip, the number of those crushed within its grasp only increases. With no way of getting the ants to locate an individual, Fabian is aware of time passing. Already, he will have been missed. But nobody should guess that here would be his destination. Part of his mind is already considering that he should have arranged for a tissue sample somehow, with which he could program an ant to track its original. Fabian often thinks about more than one thing at once, just to save time. Then he stumbles into Bianca's cell, and for a moment she rears up, frightened and angry, and he thinks she might strike him down without even hearing what he has to say. "I'm here with an offer," he hammers out hurriedly. "Portia sent you?" Bianca is suspicious. "Portia and I have taken different paths." "I know you. You are her creature. One of her males." Fabian gathers his courage. He must say it so as to make it real. "I am not hers. I am my own." Bianca watches him carefully, as though he is some prey animal behaving in an unexpected way.
"Is that so?"
"I am intending to leave Great Nest tonight," he tells her. "I will travel to Seven Trees."
"Why?"
But she is interested, inching closer. He is very aware of her fangs in this confined space. He does not know Bianca like he knows Portia. He cannot judge her limits and tolerances so well. "Because Seven Trees was rebuilt by males. Because they have been forced to accord males a value there." The flurry of her palps is a gesture of cynicism. "Seven Trees is a poor city. The males there would give all the value they are held in to be looked after by a strong Great Nest peer house, just as you have been. Life is hard there, I have heard."
"Yes, you have heard," he echoes.
"And yet I would make the opposite exchange. I would have my own peer house, however poor. I would give away all of Portia's in exchange for some small territory of my own." She makes a disgusted gesture.
"How happy I am that you came here merely to tell me this. I wish you a swift journey.
Perhaps you will accompany me."
"You'll have to wait until Portia exiles me, then, and hope that whatever they taint me with will not see the ants of Seven Trees becoming as hostile to me as those of our home,"
Bianca taps out bitterly. "You have been in communication with Seven Trees already." Fabian feels he must come out and say it. For a moment, Bianca is still. Then a short gesture prompts him to continue. "I went to your chambers after you were exposed as a heretic, after they took you captive. I read some of the notebooks you had made your notes in. They fit with philosophies and ideas that Portia's agents report are current in Seven Trees. I saw many parts and pieces in your workshop. It occurred to me that one could construct many useful things with them, and not just the telescopes that you were known for. A radio, perhaps?" Bianca regards him stonily. Her words are stepped out stiffly. "You are a dangerous little monster. I'm just a male who has been allowed to use his brain. Will you come with me? You have some trick to come and go if you are not here at Portia's orders." Bianca understands. "I have some tricks, yes. I have some tricks that Seven Trees may be glad of," if we reach there. 7 trees, Bianca considers. 7 trees will be the first city to feel the bite of Great Nest. I know what Portia has been planning, even down here. You may not enjoy your new home long. Then I will go somewhere else. Anywhere else but here. Fabian skips a little dance at the time-wasting, feeling that eventually someone will come to look for him, or simply to look in on Bianca. Perhaps it will even be Portia. What would she make of these 2 conspirators together? Come then, Bianca confirms. Great Nest has lost its appeal for me, now it's shrunk to the confines of this chamber. Show me your trick. He shows her more than that. For rather than exit upwards into Great Nest, he reprograms 20 of the guards into miners. Bianca's own insect custodians dig her escape tunnel, and by morning, the 2 of them are well on the way to 7 trees. Chapter 5.5 The Oldest Man in the Universe. Holston had assumed it would be the cage for him, but apparently things had moved on somewhat in Crazyville. The weird shanty town of makeshift partitions and tents that he had glimpsed briefly before was now all around him. It baffled him, really. There was no weather in the Gilgamesh, and any extremes of temperature were likely to prove fatal. And yet everywhere, people here had put up makeshift cover against the non-existent elements, draped lines and blankets and cannibalized wall panels to demarcate personal territories that were barely big enough to lie down in. It was as if, after so many centuries spent in cold coffins, the human race was unwilling to be freed from their confines. He had previously only got a decent look at those votaries who had overseen his captivity. Now he was being held, under guard, in what he recognized as the communications suite. How long ago, how short a remembered time ago, he had sat here, trying to initiate contact with the Bryn Sentry habitat. Now the consoles were folded away, or ripped out, and the very walls were invisible beneath layers of encrusting humanity. They peered out at him, these long-haired, grimy inheritors of the Ark. They talked to one another. They stank. He was ready to loathe them, and be loathed right back, observing these degenerate savages locked in the bowels of a ship that they were slowly destroying. He could not do it, though. It was the children that dissuaded him. He had almost forgotten children. The adults all seemed to possess some disconcerting quality. People who had been fed a narrow range of lies that had slowly locked their faces into expressions of desperate tranquillity, as though to admit to the despair and deprivation that so clearly weighed on them would risk losing them the favour of God. The children, though, the children were still children. They fought and chased each other and shouted and behaved in all the ways he remembered children doing, even back on toxic Earth where their generation had no future but a slow death. Sitting there, he watched them peeping out, running at the sight of him, then creeping back. He saw them fabricate their little half-worlds between them, malnourished and frail and human in a way that Holston felt neither their parents nor he himself still were. It had been a long road to here from Earth, but not as far as he himself had travelled from their state of innocence. The burden of knowledge in his head burned like an intolerable coal. The certainty of dead Earth, of frozen colonies. A star-spanning empire shrunk to 1 mad brain in a cold satellite. And the Ark overrun by the monkeys. Holston felt himself coming adrift, cut loose from any emotional anchor. He had found a point where he could look forward, futurewards, and see nothing that he could possibly want, no hoped-for outcome that was remotely conceivable. He felt as though he had reached the end of all useful time. When the tears came, when his shoulders unexpectedly began shaking and he could not stop himself, it felt like 2,000 years of grief taking hold of him and twisting at him, wringing out his exhausted body over and over until there was nothing left. When 2 large men eventually came for him, one of them touched his shoulder almost gently to get his attention. That same reverence he had noticed when he had been their caged pet was still present, and his outburst seemed only to have deepened it, as though his tears and his misery were worth vastly more than any of theirs. "I should make a speech," he thought wryly. "I should stand up and urge them, 'Throw off your chains. You don't have to live like this.' Except what do I know about it? They shouldn't be here at all. Not three generations of ship rats living in all the spare space of the ship, breathing all the air, eating all the food." He had no promised land he could lead them to, not even the green planet. Full of spiders and monsters, and would the ship even survive the journey there? Not according to Lane. He wondered whether Guyon had thought past the point of his own ascension. Once some corrupted, half-demented copy of his mind was uploaded into the Gilgamesh's systems, would he watch the suffering and death of his grey followers with equanimity? Had he promised that he would take them along with him to life everlasting? Would he care when the adults that these children grew into starved or were cut short by the failure of the Gil's life support? "Take me to him," he said, and they helped him hobble away. The denizens of the Tent City watched him as though he was going to intercede for them with a malign deity, perhaps one whose supplicants could only carry the messages of the faithful after their hearts had been torn out. Shuttle bays were some of the largest accessible spaces on board. His cage had been in one, and now here was another. The shuttle was missing again, but more than half the space was cluttered with a vast bank of machinery, a bastard chimera comprised of salvage from the Gil and ancient relics from the terraform station. At least half of what Holston was looking at did not seem to be connected to anything or fulfilling any purpose. Just scrap that had been superseded but not disposed of. At the heart of it, actually up on a stepped dais, constructed unevenly of metal and plastic, was the upload facility, the centre of a web of cables and ducts that spilled from its coffin space, and the focus of a great deal of the supporting machinery. But not all of it. Some of it now appeared to be keeping Guyon alive. He sat on the steps before the uploader, as though he was a steward awaiting a vanished king, or a priest before a throne fit only for the celestial. But he was steward and king both, minister of his own divinity. His appearance was plain proof that the ragged cult he had surrounded himself with was still capable of working with the Gil's technology, most especially the medical bay. Guyon sat there, quite naturally, as though at any moment he might get up and go off for a stroll. But just as the upload facility was threaded through with connections to the ship, so was Guyon. He wore robes that lay open over a ship suit that seemed to have been patched together from several older garments. But none of it hid the fact that two thick, ridged tubes had been shunted up under his ribs, and that one of the machines beside him seemed to be doing his breathing for him, its flaccid, rubbery sacks rising and falling calmly. A handful of thinner pipes issued from just past his left collarbone, like the flowering bodies of some fungal infection, before running into the mess of medical devices and presumably cleansing his blood. It was all familiar to Holston from back home, and he was aware that the Gil must store equipment like this for the extension of life in extreme cases. He had not expected to witness an extreme case, though. He was the oldest man in existence, after all, and if anyone was going to need this stuff, it would be him. Guyon was an extreme case. Guyon had beaten him to that title by a comfortable margin. Lane had said he was old, but Holston had not really processed the concept. He had thought he knew what old meant. Guyon was old. The commander's skin was a shade of grey Holston had never seen before, bagged and wrinkled about his face where his cheeks and eye sockets had sunk in. Those almost hidden eyes did not seem to focus, and Holston was suddenly sure that somewhere there was a machine that was seeing for Guyon as well, as though the man had just started outsourcing his biology wholesale. "Commander," absurdly. Holston felt a curious reverence creeping in on him as he spoke, as though he was about to be born again into Guyon's ridiculous cult. The man's sheer antiquity placed him beyond the realm of human affairs, and instead into that of the classicist. Guyon's lips twitched, and a voice came from somewhere amid that nest of botched technology. "Who is it? Is it Mason?" It was not Guyon's voice, particularly. It was not really anyone's voice, but something dreamt up by a computer that thought it was being clever.
Commander, it's me, Halston Mason.
The mechanical sound that followed was not encouraging, as though Guyon's reaction was too foul-minded for his mechanical translator to pass on. Halston was suddenly reminded that the commander had never particularly liked him.
I see you've got the uploader,
Halston petered out. He had no idea what the uploader was doing.
No thanks to you,
Guyon croaked. Abruptly he stood up, some sort of servos or exoskeleton lifting him bonelessly to his feet and perching him there incongruously, almost on his toes.
Running off with your slut? I might have known I couldn't depend on you. All the travelling I've been doing since your clowns woke me up has been entirely the idea of other people,
Halston shot back hotly.
But seriously, you don't expect me to ask questions, given what I've seen here? You have people just, what, living out their lives here over the last 100 years? You've set yourself up like some kind of crazy god emperor and conned all those poor bastards into being your slaves.
Crazy, is it?
For a moment, Halston thought Guyon would rush at him, pulling all those tubes out of himself on the way. But then the old man seemed to deflate a little.
Yes, well, I can see how it might look crazy. It was the only way, though. There was so much work. I couldn't just burn through science and engineering, using up their lives like I've used up my own.
But Halston waved a hand towards the cluttered mass of machinery at Guyon's back. How can this even happen? Okay, the uploader, it's old tech. It's going to need fixing up, troubleshooting, testing. That much I understand. But not a century of it, Guyon? How can you have been doing this for so long and got nowhere?
This? Guyon spluttered. You think the uploader took all that time?
Well, no, I... Yes. Halston frowned, wrong-footed.
What did then? I've gone over the whole damn ship, Halston. The drive's been upgraded. The system security. The hull shielding. I'd say you'd not recognize the specs of the Gilgamesh, if I thought you had any idea what they looked like before.
But... Halston waved his hands as if trying to encompass the magnitude of what the other man was saying.
Why? Because we're going to war, and it's important that we are ready for it when we arrive.
To war with... Suddenly understanding struck. With Kern? With the satellite?
Yes!
Spat Guyon, his lips quivering, the artificial sound of the single word far grander than anything he could surely make on his own.
Because we've seen it now. The ice worlds, and that grey abomination we've left behind. And then, there's the green planet. The life planet. The planet our ancestors made for us. And we all thought the same when we saw that. We thought, that's going to be our home. And it is! We'll go back and take out the satellite, and we'll finally be able to stop journeying. And then, what you see here, that so offends you with how unnatural it is, all these people, living and breeding, that will be right again. Normal service will resume. The human race can pick up at last, after a hiatus of 2,000 years. Isn't that something to strive for?
Halston nodded slowly. Yes, I suppose it is.
And when that's all done, after I've worked a generation of specialists from cargo to death, Mason, to death from sheer old age, after I've taken their descendants and had them taught and brought them in on my vision, brought them up on it, and then prepared ourselves to defend against the satellite's weapons and its attacks, why would I not go back to the upload facility and try to get it to work? Do you think any of this would have happened without me? Do you understand how important having a single vision is? This isn't something to delegate to some committee. This is the survival of the human race. And I'm old, Mason. I've worked nobody harder than I've worked myself, and I'm on the brink of collapse. Every scrap of medicine we have is needed just to keep my organs working. And it's still not done. It's not finished. I need to see it through. I'm going to upload myself into the machine, Mason. It's the only way I have of being sure.
You want to be immortal?
It had been intended as an accusation, but it came out as something else. Something with a hint of respect. There was a ghastly choking sound, and for a moment Holston thought that Guyen was actually dying. But no, he was laughing.
You think that's what this is? Mason, I'm dying. The uploader doesn't change that. The me I live inside will die. And soon. Before we see the Green Planet again. I can't even go back to the coffins now. There's no way I'd ever wake up. But now that I've got the uploader working, I can preserve a copy of me to make sure things work out. I'm not some mad dictator, Holston. I'm not some crazy man with delusions of divinity. I was given this task, to shepherd humanity to its new home. There's nothing more important than that. Not my life, not yours.
Holston realized unhappily that his own moral compass was spinning by now. Lane thinks you'll wreck the Guild's systems if you try that. She says there are copies of your test subjects running riot through the software.
I'm my own test subject, Guyen growled. Anything in the system is just cast-offs of me. But none of them worked. None of them were me. Not enough of me. But what little work I could squeeze out of you before you went gallivanting has served. Perhaps that's irony. It's ready now. I can complete an upload, and then it doesn't matter if I die. When I die, it won't matter. And as for Lane, Vetus doesn't think it'll destroy the computer. Vetus wants me to do it.
On Holston's list of reassuring things to say, that phrase did not feature.
Lane seems pretty sure it's going to be a bad thing. Lane doesn't know. Lane thinks small. She lacks dedication.
Guyen glowered, his face screwing up like a piece of paper.
Only I can plan long enough to save us, Mason. That's why they chose me.
Holston stared up at him. The guards were some distance back, and it came to him that he could leap on decrepit old Guyen and just start pulling things out until nature took its course. And also that he had no intention of doing so.
Then why did you grab me back if you didn't need me?
Guyen took a few stalking mechanical steps, pulled up by the leash of his life support.
You're our star historian, aren't you? Well, now you get to do the other part of your job, Mason. You get to write the histories. When they tell each other how we came to live on that green world, that other Earth, I want them to tell it right. So tell it right. Tell them what we did, Mason. Write it down. What we do here creates the future, the only possible future that will see our species survive.
Chapter 5.6 Resource War. The Spider City-States operate a variety of mining concerns, but they themselves do not dig. They have insects for that. One of the tasks that comes more naturally to the ant colonies they use in so many different ways. For centuries, there has been enough for all, since spider technology is not metal-heavy, and the organic chemicals, more important to them, are fabricated from the common building blocks of life itself. This is where it starts. An ant from a colony run by seven trees is now making its way deeper into a set of galleries at some distance from the city itself. Its colony extends all around it. The mine workings are its home, and its siblings' excavations just a modified form of the same tunnelling they would use to expand their nest. True, much of the colony extends into solid rock, and the ants use modern techniques to conquer that element. Their mandibles are fitted with metal picks, assisted by a selection of acids and other substances to weaken the stone. The colony plans its own mine, including drainage and ventilation to make the place a conducive workplace for the hundreds of blind miners who toil there. This particular ant is exploring for new seams of copper within the rock. The metal ore leaves traces that its sensitive antennae can detect, and it gnaws and works patiently where a trace is strongest, digging inch by inch towards the next deposit. This time, instead, it suddenly breaks through into another tunnel. There is a moment of baffled indecision as the digger teeters on the brink, trying to process this new and unexpected information. After that, scent and touch have built up a sufficient picture of its surroundings. The message is clear. Other ants have been here recently, ants belonging to an unknown colony. Barring other conditioning, unknown colonies are enemies by default. The ant spreads the alarm immediately, and then goes forth to investigate. Soon enough, it encounters the miners of the other colony, and outnumbered, is swiftly killed. No matter. Its siblings are right behind it, summoned by its alert. A cramped, vicious fight takes place, with no quarter given by either side. Neither colony has received instructions from its spider masters to cross this particular line in the sand, but nature will take its course. The second colony, that had literally undermined the Seven Trees' workings, has been sent out by Great Nest to seek for new sources of copper. Shortly thereafter, centuries of diplomacy begin to break down. Since contact with the messenger was first established, metals consumption has increased exponentially in an attempt to keep up with the complex blueprints that form the divine plan. Those cities like Great Nest that are most fervent in pursuing God's design must push outwards constantly. Supply cannot keep up with demand unless new mines are opened or appropriated. Consequently, more mining works are being contested between rival colonies. Elsewhere, caravans of mineral wealth fail to reach their proper destination. In a few cases, entire mining colonies are uprooted, driven away, or suborned. Those who lose out are all relatively small cities, and none of them strong adherents of the message. A storm of diplomacy follows, amidst considerable uncertainty as to what has actually happened. Open conflict between spider cities is almost unknown, since every city is bound to its neighbours by hundreds of ties. There are struggles for dominance, but thus far in their history, the point has always been that there must be something to be dominant over. Perhaps it is due to the nanovirus, still working towards unity between those that bear its particular mark of Cain. Perhaps it is simply that the descendants of Portia Labiata have developed a worldview in which open brute conflict is best avoided. All this will change. Eventually, when the truth becomes sufficiently evident to all parties, the transmitters of Great Nest issue an ultimatum to its weaker neighbours. It denounces them as straying from the purity of the message, and claims for itself the right to take whatever steps it must to put into effect the will of God. Transmissions from the messenger, though always obscure and open to interpretation, are taken to endorse Great Nest's proclamation. Slowly at first, and then more and more rapidly, this outright division spreads from local differences into a global fragmentation of ideology. Some faithful cities have thrown in their lot with Great Nest's vision, whilst others, distant others, have set up rival claims based on different interpretations of the messenger's commands. Certain cities that had already begun to turn away from the message have pledged support to those cities that Great Nest has threatened, but those cities themselves are not united in their response. Other cities have declared independence and neutrality, some even severing all contact with the outside world. Sister conflicts have sparked up between states which perhaps have always rubbed along with a little too much friction, always jostling for legroom, for food, for living space. At the disputed mining sites, many of which have changed hands several times by this point, Great Nest sends in dedicated troops. Another task that ant colonies will perform without special conditioning is to fight unfamiliar ants, and a mining colony is no match for an invading army column equipped with special castes and technologies. In 2 months of hard warfare, not a spider has died, but their insect servants have been slaughtered in their thousands. Great Nest can draw upon a vastly larger and more coordinated army than its opponents, and one that is better designed and bred for war. But those first months are still inconclusive. When Portia and her fellows gather together to review their progress, they are faced with an unwanted revelation. "We had thought to find matters settled," Portia considers, listening to her peers weave together their next moves, a sequence of steps that will lead them to... where? When the original actions over the disputed mining sites were agreed, their purpose had seemed very plain. They all knew they were in the right. The messenger's will must be done, and they needed copper in great quantities, copper that Seven Trees and the other apostate cities would have little use for, save to trade to Great Nest at a ruinous cost. So, seize the mines. That had been a simple aim in itself, and it has been accomplished relatively quickly and efficiently, all things considered. And yet it seems that building the future is never so simple. Each thread always leads to another, and there is no easy way to stop spinning. Already Portia's agents in Seven Trees and the other cities know that Great Nest's enemies are building and training forces to take back the mines, and perhaps to do even more. Meanwhile, the peer group magnates of her enemies are engaging in similar debates over what is to be done. Every council has its extremists who push for more than mere restitution. Abruptly, to call for moderation is to seem weak. All around Portia, there are those saying that more must be done to secure Great Nest from its new-minted enemies, and thereby to secure the will of their divine creator. They are performing that oldest of tricks, constructing a path by which to reach a destination. Only in this case, the destination is permanent security. With each step they take towards it, that security recedes. And with each step they take, the cost of progressing towards such security grows, and the actions required to move forward become more and more extreme. Where will it end? Portia wonders. But she cannot bring herself to voice her doubts. An ugly mood has come to the web-walled chamber. Great Nest has its spies in other cities, individuals and whole peer groups who have been bought or who are sympathetic to the dominant city's ideology. Equally, those other cities will have their agents in Great Nest. Previously, this interconnectedness of cities has always been a virtue, a way of life. Now it is a cause for suspicion, straining the bonds between peer groups, awakening division and distrust. Nothing is being decided here, so she heads for Temple. It seems plain to her that guidance is needed. She transmits as good a report of the situation and her concerns as she can, knowing that, while her speech to the messenger will be private, God's response will be received by anyone listening on Great Nest's frequency, which will certainly include some residing in Seven Trees. The record of the messenger in dispensing practical advice is not good, as Portia is painfully aware. She knows she cannot expect something so much grander than her to spare much consideration for the lowly affairs of her creations. God is intent on her machines that will apparently solve many problems, not least that of the maddeningly imperfect communication between the messenger and those she has set below her. Portia is not expecting a clear response, therefore, but the messenger seems to understand her better than she realized. The intended meaning is not precisely clear, for despite a painstakingly negotiated common language, the messenger and her congregation are separated by a gulf of common ground and concepts that is only slowly being filled. However, Portia understands enough. The messenger is aware that there are differences of opinion amongst her creation. She knows that some, like Portia, work hard to fulfil her directives. She knows that others, such as the temple in Seven Trees, do not, and indeed have lost much of their reverence for the messenger and her message. She instructs Portia now that the very future of her people is dependent on her will being executed precisely and promptly. She states that a time of great danger is coming, and only by obeying her will may this be averted. She says, in words clear enough for Portia to understand without a trace of uncertainty, that Portia should take any and all steps to reach her goal, and that there is no higher goal than this. Portia retreats from the temple, prey to a whirl of mixed emotions. Spider feelings are not human feelings, but there is something in her of shock, also something of elation. Never before has the messenger spoken so clearly. Great Nest's hand has now been forced. Not only has their duty to God been personally reaffirmed, but spies in Seven Trees and the other enemy cities will also have heard God's latest words, and they will hardly have to wonder hard about what question could have yielded that dogmatic answer. Life in Seven Trees has not turned out to be as free and effortless as Fabian hoped. Bianca, at least, has fitted in well enough. Her contacts, amongst the astronomical sorority, have seen her installed comfortably into a respected peer group, although a powerful peer house in Seven Trees is still considerably smaller and poorer than even a mediocre house in Great Nest. She did offer to find Fabian a favoured position there, and indeed worked quite hard to import him with her, perhaps to quit a debt of gratitude, or perhaps because she has seen how useful that dangerous little mind of his can be. He refused. Life has been difficult for Fabian during the months since, but he has a plan. He has begun to ascend the thread of life, and this time, as nobody's pet or favourite, acting without patronage and without sacrificing his vaunted freedoms. Males in Seven Trees may have more freedom and influence than in Great Nest, but they can still be killed out of hand. They still have no more rights than any momentary usefulness grants them. Seven Trees also has its gutters, though there is less of an underclass than Great Nest, just as there is less of everything else. But there are still surplus males and females down on their luck, each prey for another, just fallen corpses to be cleared away by the maintenance ants. Fabian was nearly killed several times before he was able to take the first steps in establishing himself as a diminutive power within Seven Trees. Hungry females stalked him. Delinquent males chased him from their territories, and he grew shrunken from starvation and exposure. At last, though, he was able to make contact with some females who had lost everything. It had not quite descended into unthinking cannibalism. He managed to catch them on the very cusp of savagery. They are three haggard sisters, aging scions of a peer group that is now nothing but a memory in the higher reaches of the city. When Fabian found them, they still kept a little tent of a peer house in good repair, at the very base of one of the trees that regrew here after that great and ancient war when the ants burned down the originals. They listened to him speak, taking turns to vanish from his sight, purportedly to instruct the house males concerning his meagre entertainment. He knew there were no males, and what hospitality they could muster was mere crumbs, tiny insects, and an old half-mummified mouse that they had been feeding off for days. "I will reverse your fortunes," he told them, "but you must do what I say." He needed them. It was a bitter admission, but any social group must be fronted by females, for now. "What must we do?" they had asked him. Any flavour of hope was nectar to them, even that offered by a scruffy foreign male. "Just be yourselves," he had assured them. "I will do the rest." Having attached himself to them, he had gone out with more confidence to begin recruiting. There were hundreds of abandoned males scratching a living on the ground level around Seven Trees. They lacked training, education, or useful experience, but they all had inherited understandings of one kind or another. Now Fabian sought them out, interviewed them, adopting those who had abilities he could use. Acting as merely the servant of one of the old crones he ostensibly worked for, he began to undertake jobs for more powerful peer houses, employing the chemical architecture of the ant colonies. With his unique system, it was not long before word of his prowess began to spread. The peer house of the three old females accumulated favours and barter. Soon they were spinning themselves a new house higher up on the tree, reaching for the same dizzying heights they had once known. When they tried to take it all away from him, as Fabian had known they would, he had simply stopped working. By then, the other males had grown to understand his ambition, and they downed tools as well. A new arrangement was reached. The females were free to enjoy the status that Fabian's work brought them, but his would be the mind that directed the house, and most importantly, his people were to be sacrosanct. The males of his house must not be touched. Still, it has been a long, slow road to get anywhere. As a result, Fabian's unorthodox methods have just begun to bear fruit within the social network of Seven Trees, at around the time that the mining skirmishes erupt. Once the rumours reach him, He's quick to re-establish contact with Bianca. Her position has shifted from independent scientist to political advisor, as the major peer houses of Seven Trees and its neighbours try to come up with a suitable response. Great Nest has almost contemptuously stripped them of all their minds, but nobody is keen to be the first to suggest a straight-out violent response. When diplomats contact Great Nest to try and negotiate, however, they come up against the new world that Portia has constructed after talking to God. Instead of simply beginning to exploit its own strength in return for concessions, as is traditional, Great Nest's position is uncompromising. Demands are made for other resources belonging to Seven Trees and the allied cities, farms, colonies, laboratories. When Seven Trees protests, the speakers for Great Nest label them heretics. The messenger has spoken. She has chosen her champions. This is not war. It is a crusade. Then, and only then, does Seven Trees send out a large force of fighting ants to retake the mines. They are met by a similar force from Great Nest, and a battle ensues that is only a faint echo of the tumult promised for the future. The ants fight with mandibles, with blades, with acids and fire. They fight with chemicals that confuse the enemy, drive them berserk, attack their respiratory surfaces, suborn them, and change their allegiance. The force sent from Great Nest readily obliterates the attackers. A simple radio message is received in Seven Trees, and in all of its allies' cities, the next day. Now we will come for you. Surrender yourselves to our understandings, or we will do what we must. The messenger wills it. There is chaos, then, with the loose-knit, non-hierarchical spider society threatening to tear itself apart, as it has before under intense pressure. Ruling councils rise and fall. Some advocate surrender and appeasement, others outright resistance, others simply suggest flight. None of these carries the majority. Instead, each fragments and factionalizes in turn. The stakes are higher every day. Then one day, with an army from Great Nest already dispatched and on its way, Bianca asks to be allowed to address the great and the good of the city. She finds herself positioned in the center of a web with almost 40 powerful females crouching at its edges, legs forward attentively to catch her words as the individual strands relay them. They listen intently. Everyone knows that they need a masterstroke now to save themselves, but nobody can agree on what it might be. But Bianca herself has nothing to say. Instead, she tells them, "I will bring one to you now who has found a way to combat this threat. You must listen until the end. You must hear what he has to say." The reaction is instant derision, shock, and anger. The powers that be of Seven Trees do not have time for such foolishness. There is nothing a male could have to say that they themselves have not already considered a dozen times over. Bianca presses on. "This male is from Great Nest," she explains. "It is only through his assistance that I was able to escape from there. He possesses a curious facility with ants. Even in Great Nest, his work was highly respected, but I believe he has discovered something secret, something new, something Great Nest does not yet have." At last, by such means, she is able to gather their attention, soothe them, persuade them to hear Fabian out. The male creeps out, to be pinned by their collective gaze. Fabian has given this moment some thought, based on his earlier failure with Portia. He will not ask for too much. He will show rather than tell. He will woo them, but as a female does, with success, rather than as a male, with flattery. "Give me a force of ants, and I shall defeat their army," he declares. Their response is not as negative as he had expected. They know he is a turncoat from Great Nest, after all. They question him carefully, whilst he gives evasive, cautious answers, in a fencing match of subtle vibration and non-committal gesture. He hints at having some secret knowledge of the Great Nest ant colonies, but he gives them nothing more. He watches them confer, plucking discreetly the radial strands of the web to send messages around their circle without their conference reaching the centre where he crouches. "How many ants?" one asks him at last. "Just a few hundred." He only hopes that this will be sufficient. He is risking everything on this one venture. But the smaller the force he takes with him, the more valuable will seem his victory. It is a ridiculously small force compared to the army that is encroaching on Seven Trees' territory, and in the end the females feel that there is little to lose. The only other serious alternative is to surrender and give up all they own to the peer groups of Great Nest. Fabian heads with all speed back to his own peer house and chooses a score of his most able assistants, all males. They know much of his secret, the new architecture. He and they set at once to the most laborious task, reconditioning the ants he has been gifted with to obey his primary architecture, so that they can be given instructions while on the run. The next day, they leave Seven Trees for, Fabian hopes, the annals of history. He travels with his cadre of apprentices, with his meagre force of insect soldiers, and with Bianca. The leaders of Seven Trees could not countenance a